thank you so much for joining us for the next segment of our Baker Pet Talk series. This segment focuses on pet nutrition. The Baker Pet Talks are co-sponsored by the Baker Institute for Animal Health and the Cornell Feline Health Center. All of us here at the Institute and the Center are driven by our love for animals, and we're so happy to be able to connect experts from right here at Cornell's University College of Veterinary Medicine with fellow animal lovers locally and around the globe. Just a little bit about the Baker Institute and the Cornell Feline Health Center, in case you're not familiar with us. The Baker Institute consists of researchers, trainers, and trainees, and staff committed to seeking out discoveries that will help fill major gaps in our understanding of cancer, genomics, viral diseases, and reproduction. These are discoveries that bring us one step closer to realizing our mission of creating a better future for our animal friends. The Cornell Feline Health Center is dedicated to improving the health and well-being of all cats by supporting research on diseases and conditions that affect cats, and by providing information to cat lovers, cat owners, and veterinary professionals around the world. So without further ado, let's get started. I know we're pretty anxious to hear all about pet nutrition and what we can do to keep our cats and doggies healthy. I got just a couple housekeeping items to cover. So most of you, I believe, know that this presentation is going to be live streamed because we do want this knowledge to be shared with as many people as possible. Our website has been up and has been accepting questions all throughout the week. So I will be interjecting myself in hopefully appropriate places, appropriate times, and asking the questions that have been submitted online. I encourage anyone here in the audience, in person, if you have a question, don't wait till the end. Chances are you'll forget it. So just raise your hands, either myself or Danielle, who's over there in the corner, raising her hand. She'll run over to you, hand you a mic, and that way we can all hear your question and the folks watching online can hear your question. So our presenter tonight received his DVM and his PhD from Cornell University. Go Big Red. He's a founding diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation. He's section chief and associate professor of clinical nutrition. I could probably go on with a lot of other things, but let's get started. So please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. Joseph Wachschlag.
Thanks. Appreciate it. So I was asked to come and talk about pet nutrition in about an hour. It's a pretty tough thing to actually get through in an hour. But what I'm going to actually talk about is my mind and the way I think about nutrition, and we're going to start off with not the cat's mind, because that's completely different. But there is basically a dizzying array of various media outlets, internet sources, various bloggers that talk about pet nutrition, which I get questions from the Feline Health Center, from dog people around the world, asking me to answer various questions. And there's a lot of myth and there's a lot of fact, and it's hard to really parse through what is myth and what is fact out there. And I think these are a couple of wonderful little examples where, you know, here they are. Sharon Peters is talking about the dizzying array of foods and how somebody in the pet store is making an owner feel badly about their choice, saying, you know, why are you feeding that? That's garbage. This is a better food. And, you know, if you choose A versus B versus C, all based on price, what are you getting that's different when it comes to pet food in general? And I think that's where I'm going to tell you, we don't know a lot. What we do know is that there are ingredients. We do know there are nutrients. And what we know as veterinarians and we'll say healthcare professionals, is that dogs and cats need certain nutrients. They don't need certain ingredients. They need nutrients to survive, to have what we'll call a healthy lifestyle. Now, ingredients, of course, is what really plays in our mind. And we're going to go through a lot of different ingredients today and look at some packaging to try and get an idea of what I look for. And that may be different than what blogger X looks for, may be different than what somebody else is looking for. And I won't even get into the raw controversy until later, maybe. We can have a little Q&A on that later and have a good heart-to-heart. But let's just start talking about who are the experts today. These are the experts that I get questions from. I read in the Whole Dog Journal that this is not a particularly good dog food. That's a journal, not written by experts other than breeders, and I believe they do get some nutritional input from various folks, but I don't know of any nutritionists that are actually helping them write. Dog Food Advisor actually is a fairly nice guy. He's a dentist, and I've actually had numerous conversations with him on the phone. He's trying to do the right thing, but sometimes there's a little bit of misinformation that will slide by, and some of these nuances, I think, he actually calls now and then asks me, you know, well, what do you think of this? And we've had some good conversations. PetSmart actually advertises that they have nutrition experts in their aisles to help you make the right choice. Nobody talks about what their credentials are, what certification courses they've been through, but I know PetSmart does do some training with them. I don't know exactly what that training is. And then breeders are experts, and I'm starting to see more and more contracts that come with puppies. You can only feed a grain-free food. You can only feed a home-prepared raw diet. You can only feed X, Y, or Z, and then people come to me going, is this a good recommendation? And I say, well, it comes down to what you're looking to do with the dog, what's your ethos on feeding. There's a lot of things that go into that. And then there's actually a website that's actually run by pet food advocates called Truth About Dog Food. And they take a stance on the end of we'll say, whole food feeding, that you really, really don't know what's in your dog food. And I guess we can debate if we really know what's in dog food or not. Then there are a couple of organizations that we as veterinarians really sort of rely on and send our owners to. World Small Animal Vet Association and then Tufts Veterinary Nutrition. They have wonderful articles about corn. They've got wonderful articles about grain-free. They have wonderful articles about protein, what to do if your dog's got diarrhea. All kinds of nice resources for you guys to look at and you know, start to make some of your choices based on what you're reading. So I'm going to tell you that why do you guys feed the foods you feed to your dogs and cats? Shout it out. Why? Why do you feed what you feed? If you're a student, I understand. You get it for a reduced price. Okay.
My dogs do well on it.
Okay.
Small poops.
Small poop. Small poop's huge. That's a huge, well, it's not huge. It's small. It's exactly what we're looking for. Right. Good coat quality, good muscling. Is the dog vibrant and active? Is your cat running around the house? Does he have a shinier coat? Yeah. Really? Okay, so I don't know if I made that recommendation, but hopefully it seemed to work. Okay, so yeah, you have to go to a more elemental type of a diet.
Hoping against hope that my cat gets thinner.
Hoping and just keep hoping. I'm going to go through that portion. We're going to talk about my cat. I'm sure you live the same dream.
I had a cat that was constantly throwing up. And
yep. It's worked. Yep, and I think that's what we're looking for, right? A more formed stool, no vomiting, no diarrhea. Those are the things we're looking for. And it's amazing, you'll see what's in pet foods to help actually help create that firm stool that you can pick up and scoops nicely out of the litter box less frequently. That's what the companies are actually going for. That's what they're looking to do, is create the perfect poop every time. So that said, these are the things that we're kind of looking for, and we see them, and the reality is that dog food has done a pretty darn good job of kind of keeping our dogs consistent, keeping them in a good weight. They tend to like the food. I mean, we're looking for that they eat it with vigor. They don't kind of pick through it and just nibble. We want to see them eat because we feel that love is food, and if they eat it well, then we're doing a good job. Well, the reality is that, you know, from our perspective as vets, it's all about the nutrients in that food. So I could just give you a whole list of ingredients that are things you don't understand because they're amino acids and fatty acids, and you'd be like, what's this? That's not rice. That says cysteine, and that says arachidonic acid. Well, you know, why is that in food? Well, those are the nutrients they actually require in all reality, and that's actually set by the NRC, the National Research Council, that sets our requirements for us. There's actually a dog and cat committee that gets together. I'd like to say they get together often, but it's like every 20 to 25 years, okay? We're not quite as important as people, or they're not quite as important as people. And the bottom line is that they establish all those things, and then there's a regulatory body, well, it's loosely a regulatory body. Each state has an AFCO official, American Association of Feed Control Officials. And those AFCO officials in each state basically give a rubber stamp to the food based on whether that food is meeting the NRC's recommendations in rough, okay? And so AFCO basically gives you the stamp and says, yep, your food looks like it's gonna be completely safe and healthy to feed the dogs and cats in our state, and then they allow you to sell it in that state. And you have to actually file that paperwork around the nation to actually sell your food. So It's easy to make a dog food. It's actually hard to get it through all the paperwork across all the states in an effort to sell it. So what we like to do is add a little bit of this. I'm the worst. We did a study a while back with somebody out of Central Michigan, Rochelle Herberger, and she did surveys. What do you feed your dog? And they had a huge human, you know, diet history thing. And I was expecting them to be feeding apples and carrots, but it was more like pizza crust, French fries, and things like that. That made it on the list more often than the green bean did. Okay, so people were feeding a lot of different things, and that made up over 20% of their calories, right? So as we start to anthropomorphize, thinking I like that steak, but I don't like the fat on the side of it, I'll feed it to the dog because he's a carnivore, he can handle it. Well, all I'm doing is adding caloric density without a whole lot of, we'll call, nutritional value in some of the things I'm using. So, you know, the bottom line is it can also be a little bit dangerous. So we've learned through these types of things that onions don't go with dogs and cats. We learned that garlic, fresh garlic, is not very good for red blood cells in dogs and cats. We've learned that grapes and raisins can cause kidney problems in some breeds of dogs. So, of course, chocolate, we all have heard, dark chocolate, can't do it, it can kill your dog. So the more we anthropomorphize and start adding all these things in, the more we learn. And sometimes dogs and cats just can't tolerate certain things. And so those things are off our list as far as things that we want to give. So my mentor originally showed me this slide a long time ago. And he used to say, look at the dizzying array of foods that you can select at the grocery store. Okay, that was the grocery store, because that's the only place you could buy food. In the 70s, then you got into Agways, right, and some of these feed supply stores. All right, now I got PetSmart, 7 aisles on one side for the dogs, 5 for the cats. So that's 12 aisles. And I was told that it was a dizzying array when there was one side of an aisle, right? And you can even see there's things in there that don't exist anymore, Calcan and Martin's Technical, all these cool foods that just don't exist because the market has evolved tremendously in the past, you know, 40 years. So the real question is, can you do that? Can you actually open up a can of good old-fashioned Alpo and eat it and expect to survive for the rest of your life if you're going to eat it as a human? The kids in the back are giving me a face like, oh my God. Look, it looks like meatballs. They're perfectly delicious. Can you do it? Could you actually eat this dog food and live the rest of your life healthy? Hypothetically, yes. For most of the foods out there, if you're meeting a dog's requirement, you're definitely meeting a human's requirement for most things.
What about cats?
Cats have even higher requirements in certain things than dogs because of the carnivore metabolism, right? So you can eat a cat food, and man, that's like gourmet. That's eat as much pate. And there are people who have done that. There have been blogs on people who have actually put out a can of cat food with pates, and people have eaten it and felt that it was just as good as the pates that are out there. Though some of the bloggers are like, yeah, this is what we did. We had a dinner party. They ate that stuff with gusto. Okay? So you can eat it. It's perfectly good. Only thing you might run into as a human is scurvy. Okay, vitamin C is not in all these dog and cat foods because dogs and cats make their own. So that's the one major nutrient where we would have some potential problems. So eat an orange and your Alpo. So really the whole idea of what we have to read food label, you know, I'm just going to say they do the best they can, but when we read pet food labels, it's a bit confusing. We don't really understand what some of these things mean, and I'll go through how I appreciate them, but I think there are some problems. So the FDA has a Center for Veterinary Medicine, and they actually are the one that take all the phone calls about recalls. I think my dog is sick because of the food. They log all that stuff, and they're the ones that actually release the recalls on X, Y, and Z. So the Center for Veterinary Medicine does a pretty good job of that. AFCO is really more in charge of making sure that everything is in those foods that's supposed to be in those foods. And they actually have a model regulations for pet food and basically a standard that's adopted by all. Okay. Basically, your food has all the nutrients in it that are necessary for growth, necessary for maintenance, or necessary for gestation lactation. And so you make those claims based on the calculations of all the nutrients in your food and your labeling, and AFCO says, yes, we believe you, give you a stamp of approval, it goes on the shelf. Now, these are the things that have to be on a label. You can see it's an old label from my mentor, too, because I think it's kind of cool to see some of these old labels, because there's a lot less words than there are now, okay? But the reality is it doesn't have to say a whole lot. It has to have the net weight, okay? Just like anything, you know, weights and measures are an important part of American life. It has to say who it's for: beef and liver dinner for dogs, for cats, for canaries, for whoever. It has to have this guaranteed analysis, which is, of course, right here. It doesn't have a whole lot there. We'll go through that a little bit. It has to have a product name, so you got to be able to know what your product is. You got to be able to contact the manufacturer. And probably one of the most important things is a nutritional guarantee. And it basically says that this food has been formulated or it has been fed in a feeding trial, and it meets the nutrient requirements for a dog and cat. And so those are two different things. One is I can put it through a computer program, it calculates out all the nutrients, or I can put it together and feed it to maintenance for dogs. So if I can get 10 dogs, feed it to them in a feeding trial for 6 months. If they are healthy, have normal stools, and they have their good red blood cell count and a good white blood cell count and some chemistry parameters are normal throughout that feeding period, I can then feed that. Okay, and I can label it and put it on the market. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both systems. Very few, actually, more and more are starting to do it, but feeding trials are not done very often. And to be honest with you, the feeding trials are very cursory. They're not telling you that you actually have to meet anything for a long, long period of time. And for an example is if I had a subclinical copper deficiency, and copper is a required trace nutrient, I got a lot in my liver stored up. So I might not see a deficiency for 2 or 3 years. So that's why feeding trials are great, because it tells you whether dogs eat it, whether they maintain their weight, whether they have normal stools, things like that. But it doesn't tell you a tremendous amount about, is it going to keep my dog alive forever? That's why a lot of people like to kind of rotate foods, because they're like, well, if one food were to have a mild deficiency in something, if I feed food Y, I might make up that deficiency over time. And I know a lot of nutritionists actually like to kind of rotate every 3 to 6 months, just to kind of say, well, you know, you never know, and we're worrywarts, we're veterinarians. Veterinarians worry about everything, okay? And then the last and the most important thing that I think we all read and we actually have an understanding of is this wonderful ingredient panel. Unfortunately, AFCO doesn't really do a great job of telling you what's truly in there. What's byproduct? Well, why don't I just say poultry, livers, kidneys, necks, legs, feet, you know, eggs that were in there, clean GI tract. I mean, that's what it is, right? So it's all the goodies on the inside. So the reality is it's kind of hard, and those definitions don't, they're not consumer-friendly looking definitions. But according to my labeling, I have to put in that ingredient. I have to label it according to AFCO. I can't say, if I had liver, kidney, and tripe, all together in a gamish, I can't call it kidney, liver, tripe. I have to call it byproduct, okay? So that's kind of the nuances behind AFCO. So that said, one other thing has to be on there, and that's the feeding directions. And the reality is most feeding directions are egregious in terms of the calorie consumption that they actually recommend for dogs and cats. And that's because it's not done on these studies that on metabolism were not done on Labradors that lay on your couch all day, or a cat whose son's in your front sill all day. These were done on colony cats that are a lot more active. It's done on beagles who run around in cages all day, in these facilities. And they're much more active. They have more playtime than my dog. I know that. So they end up having a higher calorie consumption. There's a huge window. And I always tell people, when in doubt, feed on the low end of the feeding instructions for just about any food that's out there, because the low end is at least going to be closer to reality for your average dog of average activity, except for maybe yours, Marge. So that's pretty much what we have to work with. And do you understand that? Crude protein, what is that? That's actually the nitrogen content. And nitrogen is the primary, or protein is the primary source of nitrogen. So that is what crude protein is. It's telling you the nitrogen source. Is it telling you about the quality? Is it telling you about digestibility? It's not telling you, it's just saying we think there's roughly 26% protein in here. telling you about amino acid balance, because that's what protein is. It's a whole series of amino acids that are essential to the body. 10 of them are essential. The other 10 are, you know, you can make some of them. But that's what it's saying, is that, you know, we think you're going to get a nice slug of protein here, right? Crude fat is basically telling you about the overall fat content. It's actually not a bad measure of fat that's in the diet, okay? But is it telling you anything about healthy fats? We all hear about healthy fats today. It's not telling you about the healthy fats or unhealthy fats and things of that nature. Crude fiber is a maximum, okay? So they don't want to, basically I put on my label that I have 3% crude fiber. I sure don't want to have over 3%, because if somebody analyzes it and there's 4 or 5, that's considered filler. But the reality is most of that comes with your carbohydrate sources. So brown rice, right? All the things that we're supposed to be eating, brown rice, quinoa, barley, they have more fiber than white rice, couscous, and pasta. So fiber comes with those whole grains, all right? And then companies will add in fiber, and we'll talk a little bit about why. And then, of course, you have to put moisture content. So it's a real cursory view of what's in food, right? Protein, fat, fiber, moisture. And then you can only have up to 78% moisture in canned food, according to AFCO, unless you're a stew or a gravied type of thing. Then you can have like 84, 86. So all these little nuances to pet food. It's kind of bizarre. So what is your brand, right? And why do you choose what you choose? And that's just a small representation. And I mentioned the grocery store. I mentioned the Tractor Supply. I also mentioned PetSmart, Petco, all those huge superstores just for pets. Oh, wait a second. Then there's the small, holistic pet food stores that are independently run and owned all over the country. Every city has one. We have ours downtown, too. And they have different foods than what's in those other stores. So it's confusing, right? So what, why do you feed, you know, why do you pick the brand? I mean, yeah, it's grain-free. I get it. Why the brand? Why do you pick what you pick?
Dogfoodadvisor.com.
Dog Food Advisor. Okay. So Mike's doing a good job of getting to you. Okay. Anybody else? It's cost? Your vet recommended it. Yeah. You're in the profession, so you got to stick with what you know. Anybody else? Friends, right? Your friends told you, my dog does well on it, so I'm going to go with this brand. And don't say cost isn't a factor. Because I can go buy a bag of dog food at 40 pounds for about $16.99 at Walmart, or I can go over to Ithaca Grain and Feed and buy something for $85 or $85 for 30 pounds. So cost is a big factor for a lot of us too, right? This is what gets my hackles up, is that I walk through a small street in France, and this is what I see, is byproduct everywhere. And that's not for dogs. There weren't dogs lined up to buy this. There were people lined up to buy this, okay? So what's in your dog food is supplying nutrition. This is actually some of the best nutrition you can find, because livers and kidneys have nutrients that skeletal muscle meat does not have. So when you read that it has fresh chicken, that's all well and good, but I prefer to see a little bit of liver in there. I wouldn't mind seeing some kidney. I wouldn't mind seeing byproduct, all right? A lot of people don't like byproduct because it's considered to be the entrails. And the problem is that in the industry, there are all kinds of qualities of these things. You can, in essence, think of grade A versus grade D. There are really good, high-quality byproducts, and then there are cheaper byproducts. Usually, and to some degree, you get what you pay for, okay? But the reality is in chicken meals, poultry meals, meat and bone meals, et cetera, you're kind of getting what you pay for from the perspective of that when the supplier sends in a product, it could be really high in ash, which means a lot of bone, or it could be really low in ash, which means really low bone content, okay? And you have to think about byproduct this way. It's the insides, but it's also necks and backs for poultry. So if I have a lot of ash, I have a lot of calcium and phosphorus coming from bone, I'm going to have a really high ash chicken meal, right? Versus something that's got more meat on it or more innards, which doesn't have bone, I'm going to have low ash chicken meal. So there's a huge variety. I can go into as a ingredients supplier, I could supply you something that's around 8%, which is pretty much the whole chicken ground up, Or I can supply you something that's 25% ash, okay? And that basically is a huge variation. So it's three times the amount of ash that's in the food. Ash is just bone mineral content, the minerals that are in my body, that if I were to burn your body, what's left is a pile of ash. The stuff that we spread in the garden after one of our beloved pets dies and we want to spread their ashes, that's the ash, that's what's left over. So that said, all kinds of qualities of everything. And the reality is you have to just sort of go through the ingredient list and feel comfortable with that ingredient list. And these are the things that I sort of look for in a food. And number one thing is an animal-based protein source. So even though corn gluten and pea protein and soy protein isolate are solid and good sources of protein, they're not as complete for dogs and cats as animal-based proteins. So I prefer, not that you can't make a food with that stuff, I just prefer to see animal-based protein as my first and second, or at least just my first ingredient. If plant-based proteins make it in there, that's great because it's boosting my protein level, but it's not quite as complete of a protein as our animal-based ones. And then this whole idea of our good fats. So we need good fats in the diet. There are requirements of some of these good fats, the polyunsaturated fats. So I look to see if there's a source of that in there. Actually, to be honest, chicken fat is actually a really good source of some of the polyunsaturates, okay? So usually poultry fat makes it in there. Even animal fats will have some. And then you'll see things like canola oil or even corn oil or soybean oil. Those are good sources of the polyunsaturates and actually make me feel a little bit more comfortable that the company's thinking about putting those in. Then there's the omega-3 fatty acids, which people talk about. That is a polyunsaturate too, but it's a special one. And that's why we like to see things like fish oil or other marine oils or algae extracts. Those things will have some of these omega-3s in them. And then we look for fiber sources. Now, a lot of people think of fiber as filler, but there are certain fibers, and we'll go through some labels, that actually have been tested and show that they actually make poop more kickable. So they don't screw up your toes or your shoes when you kick it by accident. It actually smushes and you don't leave this all over your shoe, it actually just kind of compresses. So that's the nice thing about fibers, it creates perfect poop. And so a lot of companies have worked really, really hard on fiber so that you feel comfortable about poop, okay? And then we'll talk a little bit about soluble and insoluble, but that can maybe be for the end. And then there are minerals. A lot of people like to see mineral sources that are coming in what are called chelates today. So those are minerals that are actually bound to like an amino acid or a small protein or a small peptide. And those hypothetically have a slightly better absorption than minerals that are bound to oxides. So in all reality, the higher end foods, they pay a little bit more for those types of chelates as mineral in the food. And we'll see some labels that kind of go through that. Oxides are less expensive. Sulfates are kind of in the middle. And then these chelates are actually, quote unquote, a little bit more absorbable, but there's not a lot of data in dogs and cats. It's more in poultry and pigs and things like that we have data on that. And then lastly is if I have a growing dog, lysine and methionine are things I like to see. So if it says in all life stage food, because a lot of foods say it's meant for all life stages, you can feed it to puppies, you can feed it to adult dogs, you can feed it to a 15-year-old Labrador, feed it to anybody. If I'm feeding it to a puppy, I like to see those two things in there because those can be destroyed during the processing and making of the food, the natural stuff. So if you can put a little bit more of that in there, it makes me feel a little bit more comfortable that this is going to be really good for my puppy. Okay?
For dogs or also
cats? Cats as well. And then taurine, of course, is important for
so
all cats.
Everything you say for dogs applies to cats unless you're
doing Yep. We'll just kind of go through some of the differences in dogs and cats in a second. So this is what I call the basic formula, okay? And what you're going to see is the guaranteed analysis. If you read this, guaranteed analysis, crude proteins, 26, fats, 14, fibers at 4. All right, I get it. It's about the same. And every single food I'm going to show you has the exact same guaranteed analysis. So how do you make your choice between those three foods? The reality is you start looking at the ingredients. Well, this actually has porcine meat meal, some ground yellow corn, a little bit of soybean meal, and ground wheat. Meat's made it as my number one ingredient. They are using some soybean meal as a protein source. And then they're using wheat and corn. Now, I know that those types of things get people's hackles up today. However, they've been around forever, and when you actually look at the data around allergy in dogs, corn really doesn't make it to anywhere within the top five. Cats, it doesn't make it within the top five. I think wheat is number seven or something like that for dogs, and I can't remember what it is for cats. But the reality is this whole corn, soy, and wheat craze that people are into, I don't want it to have that. The reality is that those things really aren't what dogs and cats are allergic to. They're usually allergic to that major protein source, that animal protein source, more often than not. And the corn, wheat, and soy thing, it's probably a little bit more of the idea of getting away from things like aflatoxins or mycotoxins. And those are actually from fungus that grows on the wheat or the corn. And all manufacturers test for those things before they make their pet food. So those are now considered to be quality control tests that are done before you make the pet food to make sure that that ingredient is safe to put into food. Okay? However, occasionally, a third-party manufacturer decides, well, I'm just going to skip this batch. And that's what happened, and happens every 15 years. You'll get an outbreak of something that's frying the livers in dogs or causing cats to have some problems. And so that's just about quality control. And actually, to be honest with you, I think that's sort of been taken care of more recently with some new food safety and modernization programs that are in place. All right, so we keep going down here. Corn gluten meal, that's an extra bit of protein. It's pretty far down. Now we have salt, potassium chloride, et cetera, et cetera. I want you to pay attention to this, potassium chloride and salt. These, as well as choline, are major nutrients that are usually in foods, and they're at about 1% of this diet. Okay? Just keep that in mind. Now we've got all these wonderful vitamins and minerals, sulfate, oxide, vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E. So they're using sulfates and oxides for their minerals. So not a bad choice. Now we go to another one. So this one is the same guaranteed analysis. It's made with chicken meal, ground corn, brown rice, chicken fat, and they are now telling you that it's preserved with mixed tocopherols. That is different than this group, which is preserved with BHA. That's a chemical preservative, very inexpensive, great preservative, but there are negative connotations these days to chemical preservatives. There is one called ethoxyquin that really is not making it into food anymore because there is so much negative press against ethoxyquin. So we just don't see it as much as we used to. Rarely makes it into our, we'll call mid and higher tier foods because there's such negative press. So these chemical preservatives have gotten a bad press. So what we've done is we now use natural mixed tocopherols. Those are vitamin E, different variations of vitamin E that are used to preserve your food. We got some rolled oats, pearl barley, then we have this dried beet pulp. That's actually the fiber that makes things nice and pick-upable. Brewer's yeast, flaxseed meal, wheat germ, lecithin, etc. The flaxseed is actually providing omega-3s, so that's a good thing. I've got my polyunsaturates that are all coming from chicken fat, and then the omega-3s are coming from the flaxseed. The last food didn't have omega-3s in any nice slug. But I prefer to see fish these days because fish has probably got a slightly better bioactivity. Going through, methionine and lysine have made it into this food. It didn't make it into the last food. Salt right here. And then we have all the other vitamins and minerals. And you can see we have protonates, we have some oxides, we also have sulfates. So we're putting in a mix of all kinds of chelates, sulfates, etc., to potentiate slightly better absorption, hypothetically. So this is a solid food. It's got sort of all the marks have been checked. Omega-3s, I've got some polyunsaturates, it's made primarily with animal-based protein, it's got D-L-methionine, and it's got the lysine, and then I've got all these chelates, etc. They put a little bit more thought and time and energy into making this food. And then we have the kitchen sink. So you can see my font just keeps getting smaller. All right? And that's because this is deboned chicken. God, that sounds great. You're not even supposed to say deboned, because chicken's chicken. AFCO doesn't like deboned, because you're just telling them something that they should already know. But that sounds cooler and groovier, right? It's deboned chicken. It's not even boned. All right, great. So that's deboned chicken, chicken meal. And this is where it gets kind of fun, because you can see they got two major protein. It's a chicken-based diet. If I were to actually take all the water out of that chicken, it would fall somewhere down on the second line. Oh, this is dry. This is dry stuff. This is a chicken meal. It's 90% dry matter, 10% water. This is about 30% dry and 70% water. So it falls down here somewhere. So it's really a chicken meal-based diet. And what they've done is they've taken the brown rice, whole barley, oatmeal, rye, potatoes. They've now parsed out their carb sources. If they had just used rice, it would be the number one ingredient, but nobody likes to see rice as your number one ingredient, okay? So this is a little bit of trickery. It's smoke and mirrors. It's Wizard of Oz stuff, right? Who's behind the curtain? And then we actually see that we have mixed tocopherols as our preservative, and we have tomato pumice. Now, they say it's a natural source of lycopene, but guess what? Tomato pumice is kind of like beet pulp, all right? So it's not as cool as we think it is. It's fiber. Whole carrots, sweet potatoes, blue cranberries, flaxseed, barley grass, dried parsley, alfalfa meal, kelp meal, taurine, L-carnitine, lysine, glucosamine, yuca shoot agara, green tea extract, turmeric, garlic, sunflower, and then finally we get to a little bit of fish oil. That's our long-chain omega-3s from a fish source that we kind of like to see. And actually, if you look, this is definitely less than 1% of the diet. So basically, some of these things may be at 2 or 3%, but that's not a lot. It's like 6 blueberries, 2 cranberries, half of a carrot, you know, half a baby carrot. Not a lot. And now we get into green tea extract, turmeric, garlic. What the hell? Might as well put garlic in. Dried chicory root. And then we have all these cool things, fructo-oligo, mannosidos-oligo, and it's like, oh, that's the cool stuff, that fiber that ferments in my colon, and my doctor said I need more soluble fiber, so I'm on fructo-oligosaccharides for my slight GI problem. That's in the dog food. Well, that's cool, but dried chicory is the same thing as that, so why would I double dose it? I don't know. But it's fun because people recognize these ingredients, and people say, well, that's got that in there. I'm going to buy that food. I'm not going to buy that last food. And then we've got all kinds of things. Now we get to the vitamin mineral stuff, right? Copper, chelate, iron amino acid complex, chelated zinc. So they're doing all the cool stuff. They've spent the extra $2 a pound on that premix of vitamins and minerals that gets put in. And then what the hell? I'm going to go ahead and put in some lactobacillus, some bacillus subtilis, some bifidobacteria, and all these bacteria that they're dead. But I'm putting them in because people love probiotics, right? So that is a glorious example of marketing, okay? Now, if we were putting things in at therapeutic concentrations, very typically some of these things that are used in therapeutic diets actually go higher. But they've done a good job of really feeding into what we'll call the ethos of the average consumer, of what I like to see because I shop at Whole Foods, okay? But it's a perfectly good food. Not much different, actually, than the rest. It's going to have a little bit more soluble fiber, for sure, because I saw all those cool soluble fibers like chicory root and mannosidos oligosaccharides and fructooligosaccharides. So these are my top 10 questions that you should really be asking if you're this interested in what's going into your dog or cat. You should be calling the manufacturer. And you should be asking these questions, because this is all about food safety. This is all about can you tell me more about your food, because I'm not going to really believe that this food is 100% safe. Ash content we've talked about, that's our calcium and phosphorus. So, yeah.
Do we get a handout on this, or can we snapshot that?
You can snapshot it. I could hand it out. You could, I'll give it to anybody that wants it.
So what we can do, Dr. Wachschluck, if you don't mind, you can send this to me
sure.
via email.
Yep.
And if anyone wants to reach out to the Baker Institute, our contact information is online. Shoot us an email. I'll be more than happy to forward it to you.
Mm-hmm. And so this is basically grilling the person on the phone, right? You want to just ask them things about ash content. A typical food will have an ash content that's probably around 4%, maybe 5%. Get upwards towards 6%. So somewhere around that 5 and 6 is pretty typical. Let's say it was 10%. That's got a lot of bone in it. It's got a lot of extra stuff that your dog and cat doesn't need. Yeah?
Ash, urinary blockage in male cats, I was always told that
yeah.
Ash is an issue with that.
Yeah, a lot of the foods ash has always been an issue, and that's because back in the 70s and 80s, we were making foods with lesser quality ingredients, in my mind at least. And so they tended to be the high ash content stuff. That made it into a lot of the foods, and so they were high in magnesium and phosphorus and calcium, et cetera. And that was blamed for the higher incidence of urinary blockage. Magnesium was implicated, however, it actually really came down to higher protein and lower protein diets. And high protein diets acidify, okay? And that's why we like high protein diets for cats. That's
a, Which is good for
And a lot of the diets that were made were meeting the cat's minimum protein requirement, so they weren't considered high. Today, a lot of the diets are considered much higher. So they were barely meeting those requirements. They were putting in a lot of vegetable-based things. So urinary acidification wasn't very good. And I think we're now much more aware of that. And so every company has a urinary tract formula that helps keep the urine more acidified. And so that it got blamed on ASH primarily, but it actually was more of what we'll call a lower protein diet in general. And we'll say lesser quality ingredients, because the higher the ASH, the more bone, the less muscle meat, et cetera, right? So I get all that bone, I get all the ASH, I get the collagen, which is a protein source. It's not the best protein source compared to muscle meat, okay? So I will tell you that that's less of a problem probably today than it was 20 years ago, 25 years ago. When I was in school, it was kind of like, that was the big issue. That was mid-90s. Into the 2000s, and I think a lot of companies have sort of corrected that. Is it gone? No. And that's because cats don't like to drink water. And that's why we say if you have a male cat who's had a plug at one point in their life, you're going to feed them canned food. You can try and make that transition from the crunchies to the canned food, because that can has more water, and cats will actually get more water from eating canned food than they would from eating dry and being allowed to drink normal quantities. Okay. So that's the ASH thing. Yep.
I actually have a question from online that's related to what you were just talking about. The question comes from Chris. How can you get your cat to transition from dry to wet food? They have grain-free dry out all the time, and one cat is on urinary SO for crystals. They get wet food twice a day. I've heard wet food is better for their long-term health. I want to reduce or eliminate the possibility of kidney disease as they get older.
So that transition is ungodly difficult for that one cat in your household that just doesn't want to eat it. He'll lick the gravy off, but he won't actually eat that food. And so what you really have to do is you have to start mixing in very small chunks of it with his dry. And eventually they'll start to eat that. They'll start to accept it, but that may take, I mean, there's vets in the room. Vets, how long? 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. Sometimes it takes forever. And then there are just some cats that won't make the transition. They just love their crunchies too much. So the problem is cats aren't all there when it comes to eating. Like, they will rather starve themselves than actually eat something that they don't really want to eat.
So all they want to do is eat the crunchies, let them eat that dry food?
What I would think is that you might actually try and get them away from crunchy. So cats like sharp edges. Most of our foods for cats are made with little star shapes, triangles, pyramids. And that's because cats love that sharp feel in their mouth. And so I would get away from those kinds of foods and go to something that's round and lifeless, okay? And then try to then mix in some of the wet with that and see if you can make that transition. Everybody's had that one cat that won't actually transition over, but 99% will. It's just that 1 or 2% that just won't do it. Now, the whole idea of kidney health, you know, hydration is important for urinary tract health altogether. Now, whether your cat's going to get kidney disease or not, it probably doesn't have much to do with what form you're feeding, but as soon as your cat does have that urinary tract problem or that kidney problem, wet food is an important part of flushing the kidneys, flushing the urinary tract. And so I think the biggest recommendation is that as a kitten, you should be trying to feed both canned and wet from the get-go. Because if you can do that when you get them, they're more inclined to be very accepting of that canned food when you have to make that transition later in life.
So are you saying that any canned food would be better than the dry, because I'm giving him urinary tract dry mixed with something else, and slowly getting him to eat that. He used to eat wet food. He doesn't like wet food anymore.
Okay. you have to do what you can. So I would try to get him to eat some canned food or make sure that he's drinking, or people put out water fountains.
Yeah.
Cats play in them more.
He stopped drinking out of that too.
Yeah, because cats like to play in them more than they actually like to drink in them. So chicken broth. Flavor it up. Try to do things that actually will promote that drinking. Anything you can find. Sheep's blood. I don't care what it is. You have to get them to get more fluid into their bodies, and that's a pretty hard thing to really come by for a lot of cats. And so there's all kinds of recommendations out there, and to be honest with you, the king of epidemiology in this is Tony Buffington. And I hope Tony doesn't see this, but you should look him up. He's at UC Davis. He has sort of been dealing with cat behaviors and cat urinary tract health for 30 years. He probably has more tricks than I have.
My cat doesn't like the canned.
Oh, I'm sorry. My cat doesn't like the canned cat food. He's had urinary tract mm-hmm. trouble since he was a kitten, but he likes canned dog food.
What?
He thinks he's a dog. He was raised with him. But can I mix a little bit? How bad is canned dog food for cats? I've heard that it's not good for them.
Yeah, what I would do is I would actually look at the canned dog food and see if it has taurine in it, because that's the one major thing that doesn't make it into dog foods. And it's not perfect, but a lot of foods now have taurine added for dogs. And if not, you could actually add in 250 milligrams of taurine into that dog food and see if the cat would eat it with that in there. I'd be more comfortable with that.
Could you wait for the mic, please, so that our viewers online can hear?
I have a lot of cats, and my cats love, I feed primarily, dry, supplemented with mm-hmm. with canned food. My cats love drinking water, but I give them water in big dog bowls and not little tiny cat bowls. And I find that, I have one cat who's separated from the others in a different room. And in that room, I have the two little dishes in the right. in the dish holder thingy. That cat, it's very hard for me to get that cat to drink. I mean, but the others, they're...
Are they more
they
community?
Because that's they do play in the water, but they also really drink it. I watch them, and they really lap it up. And I think the fact that it's bigger, deeper water, it stays cooler and mm-hmm. it stays cleaner.
And I also think there's a communal thing about it where, if I have a big dog bowl, and the dog's drinking, my cat always goes up and takes a few licks. Like, hey, if you're doing it, I'm going to do it. And I think there's a communal thing about that where, if it's big enough, it's all good. But if one cat goes and drinks out of a small bowl, a second cat can't go and drink out of that bowl, right? But if you have a really large bowl, now it's kind of like, Simba and Mufasa at the watering hole, right? Where, okay, one guy's here, I've got my space, I'll come in over here, another guy can come in over here, and so there's more of a communal thing about it. And I think that keeping it cooler. I mean, I stopped putting out my cat's water bowl because he would never drink from it. It would sit downstairs and evaporate over a month, and he would sit there and drink out of the dog's bowl. But in the end, I'm also thinking the freshness of it too may have been a factor, because my dog's always drinking and I'm always filling that bowl, and I always forget the downstairs bowl where the cat is. And so there's definitely that communal thing too, I think.
I'm going to jump in with another online question mm-hmm. related to kidney disease, since we talked about it earlier. This question comes from Elizabeth. She says, my question is in two parts, but related to the same thing. My dog is not a big eater and loves to run after the ball. Therefore, she's always run a little underweight. She's now 13 and is diagnosed with kidney failure. She's running at 25% of kidney function. She's eating KD canned. She looks and acts fantastic. You'd never know. Her questions are, 1, is there anything I can do to help keep her weight up? And 2, is protein bad for dogs with kidney disease? I give her baby carrots and apple slices, small amounts for treats, which she loves, but I used to do chicken strips. Am I going overboard? What percentage of her diet should be protein? She is an 11.5-year-old Affenpinscher Shih Tzu mix mm-hmm. rescue.
So that is a strangely loaded question for somebody, because I don't have the blood work in front of me. But there are various stages of kidney disease for dogs. And in the earlier stages, the protein restriction isn't that necessary. It's phosphorus restriction. And so things like, we often talk to folks who have, let's say, hunting dogs who have gone into kidney failure. They want to keep up the lean mass. We'll actually use protein supplementation until that dog's kidneys show us the signs with the blood urea nitrogen going quite high, telling us we have to back off at that point. But as long as you have phosphorus restriction in the diet, and we do, I mean, I'd say one in every four diets that we do for a home-prepared diet for dogs is actually a kidney failure diet for people who are looking for an option that's not as low in protein as the commercial diets are these days. Because I don't think you need it in early renal failure. But if you're in later stages, which are stage 3 and 4 iris, that's where the protein restriction becomes important because you're building up nitrogen byproducts in your bloodstream and you just can't get rid of them.
We've gotten an abundance of questions about asking about raw diets. Is that something that you can speak to?
can we just wait to the end and talk about that?
Cover it then, for sure.
A bit of an ethos thing, and it's.
You got it.
Okay, so I'm not going to read through these, but these are the kind of things that you should be actually talking to them about because. A lot of folks, when you call that company, aren't going to know half of these questions. They won't have done the testing, and that's because companies can make food. As long as you stay by AFCO's standards, I don't have to do trace metals. I don't have to do heavy metals. I don't have to do mercury and lead testing. I do aflatoxin and mycotoxin testing. They should be able to give that to you. Should be able to tell you that it's so many parts per million aflatoxin, X, Y, or Z. and then some of the things that become a little bit more important is from a quality control standpoint, if I have my own factory, the big manufacturers do, the small manufacturers tend to have what I would call third-party manufacturers that make their food for them because they just can't afford a $62 million plant because that's about what it would cost to build a high-quality plant. And so they actually have it made. But what's nice is that now there are some food safety and modernization things that have gone into effect where you have to have a person there that's sort of a hazards and quality control expert that is monitoring that on a daily basis to make sure everything that you say is going to be in the pet food is in there, to make sure some of the basic microbe testing, starch gelling type of stuff is being done. So there are now measures that are making it better and safer, but nothing's perfect. And then if you actually ask them to supply you a concentration of a vitamin or a mineral, at a specific concentration in dry matter, that's great, but a really knowledgeable technical support person will be able to give it to you in the amount per calories, per 1,000 calories. And that's just a test to see how astute the technical support people are and whether the company's thinking about nutrients for dogs per calorie and cats per calorie consumed versus the dry matter, because dry matter is very different. My dog could eat two different foods and eat 600 grams of one and 300 grams of another and get all the energy they need from those two different amounts, which means that the minerals and vitamins have to be different in those two different things because one's really calorie dense, the other one's really light and fluffy. Okay, no fat in it, right? It's got more carb and protein. So those are the kind of things you might want to actually talk to people. And then because I am a board certified veterinary nutritionist, do you actually have one that you work with on your formulas and talk to on a regular basis to answer questions, things like that? So what's the difference between dogs and cats? Well, there aren't,
Can I, on the last topic of the top 10 things to ask, my number one concern has become whether or not they outsource their products from overseas. Is that really something that's founded, or is that just a fear that I'm basing on a few isolated incidences?
Yeah, it's more on isolated incidents, and the quality control overseas is not quite where it is here. Even from a manufacturer standpoint, all these food safety acts and whatnot have come into effect. Started in 2011 was when the Food Safety Modernization Act sort of started. And so we have all kinds of checks and measures in place for quality control and hazard analysis, et cetera, that just other companies don't have that are overseas. Now, if you ask me if I was getting it from Germany, I would think that I feel a little more comfortable with a European product than I would from something that's from Malaysia because they just don't have the same standards and controls. And actually, it's funny, my resident, Hunter Kim, is in the back. We talk about Korea because he's from Korea. He talks about the quality control measures in Korea are not even close to where they are here at this point, but everybody's working towards better quality control in general because they want to have things in the U.S. market. But yes, made in the USA makes us feel pretty good. Any other thoughts? So this is where science comes into play, because there are about a handful of things that make cats different from dogs. And really the major thing that's different, we'll start with dentition. Cats don't really have molars. Yeah, they got a couple of molars in the back. So molar one and two, and they're really tiny, teeny, not real non-existent things. If you have molars, it means you're supposed to be grinding up plant-based materials. If you don't, that means you're a carnivore. So even dogs have more molars than cats do. But in all reality, this is because cats have evolved to eat meat, okay? And bottom line is that cats are very different from a behavioral standpoint. I think we've already addressed that halfway through here, is that they go, they pick out three kibble, they walk away, they go meow incessantly at you, to then go back down, eat three more kibble, come back up, bother the dog, go back down, eat three more kibble. That's just how cats eat. Dogs are gorgers. They just gorge themselves to death. And cats have a higher urine concentrating capability. Their kidneys are always working overtime because they are, I like to call them desert animals. They're kind of, you know, their urine solutes, the mineral and whatnot that actually concentrates in a cat's urine is always far greater than yours or mine or a dog. And that basically tells you that they are a little bit different in terms of their water consumption. And so this comes into the dry and wet feeding. We're talking wet in general, urinary tract, kidney health, all these things when we have a problem are probably pretty important. However, if I have really bad teeth, which a lot of cats have horrible teeth, dry feeding certain diets may be better for dental health. And so I think it comes down to what's your cat's problem and trying to determine what you're going to feed them. And then this transition we've talked about. They just take longer. They don't like change. And actually, cats are known to be neophiles. They actually like something new, but they won't eat it long term. They'll go try it, have a few meals, and then they'll go back to their old thing. Okay? So that's why cats are difficult. That's why there are all kinds of cool palatants. That's why there's like five companies that just make palatants for dogs and cats and are always coming out with the next best palatant. And so palatants are what's sprayed on your kibble to make them as tasty as possible so your cat keeps going back to the bowl so he can get fat. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So the number one reason that they are different metabolically is that they require more protein, almost twice the amount that a dog requires in the diet of a good quality animal source. It's about 10 grams per kg versus 20 grams per kg in dry matter is what's required to allow them to live and have normal function. And that's all due to these enzymes in their liver. And so they cannot downregulate enzymes in their liver that actually turns protein into carb and turns protein into fat, okay? That's what happens is in the cat's liver, blood glucose still runs the world, but you have to make that blood glucose out of something if you're not taking in carbs. And that's made from protein, and cats are highly efficient at taking their protein and making it into glucose. They also have this strange requirement for something called taurine, which is sort of an amino acid derivative, part of the protein cascade. And this is the biochemistry behind it, so take a picture of that one. And the reality is that methionine and cysteine are two amino acids that are actually typically in the diet, but they kind of go into this pathway here for energy versus being made into taurine. And then cats are weird because they have these things called bile acids that help break up the fat so you can absorb it. And they only have the ability to conjugate that to taurine as part of the biologic function. So they basically lose taurine excessively in their bile. And so this creates a requirement. Now, how do we know these things? It's because we tried to feed things without taurine in them for a long time. Muscle meat is not very good. Chicken, don't work. Cod, doesn't work. Pork, a little better. Beef, eh. Guess what's number one? Mice. Mice have tons of taurine. Songbirds, plenty of taurine. Okay? So we're dealing with the wrong protein source, hypothetically, and we learned this, and that's why we put taurine in. If they ate more of the innards, they would get more taurine too. But our sort of you know, our anthropomorphization of our cats by saying, oh, they need fresh skeletal muscle meat and they're going to be happy. Not really. They actually need that whole animal. That's why chicken meal and byproduct actually makes me feel a little bit better about a food.
That's why cats like crunchy food, because mice are crunchy.
Mice are, they're very crunchy, exactly. Lots of sharp edges when you're eating the femur of a mouse, right? So, let's say this is going to, does this go viral ever and like make it on YouTube? might tonight. Okay. So vitamin E and vitamin D are very interesting because you and I and ruminants actually, we have this wonderful enzyme in our GI tract that breaks up beta carotene. Beta carotene's in all the leafy greens, carrots, all the things we eat. And so we actually get our vitamin A from that, but cats don't have that enzyme, which means they shouldn't really be, you know, evolutionarily eating plants because they haven't developed the enzymatic machinery to make vitamin A out of beta carotene like we have. Dogs could do it, right? So they're kind of special in that regard. And it's actually pretty cool because they've tried to feed toxic levels of vitamin A to cats to see if their kittens would have facial deformities like rats and things. Couldn't really do it because cats actually can take in tons of vitamin A and they excrete it through their urine pretty really efficiently compared to other species. And of course, vitamin D is actually something that's required in the diet as well in cats. Now, you and I, we have this cholesterol that circulates through our bloodstream and it circulates through and it gets to the skin and then the UV irradiation hits a specific metabolite and that turns into cholecalciferol, which is in essence vitamin D, okay? Now, dogs and cats actually can't do that. So they actually have a oral vitamin D requirement. So they can't get it from UV exposure. And of course, vitamin D is important for all kinds of things like bone and immune function and even potentially tumor growth. So sort of close to last is the fact that cats don't have a really cool enzyme. And that enzyme is an enzyme that turns linoleic acid into arachidonic acid. And so it's thought that cats actually have an arachidonic acid requirement. And guess what's full of arachidonic acid? Animal fat. Okay? So linoleic acid comes from plant fat. So my plant fats and my plant oils have linoleic. So I can't feed linoleic and my cat cannot convert that into arachidonic. And that's a required fatty acid for reproductive health. And then lastly, this whole idea of carbs, and this is one of the major arguments that cats don't like carbs or shouldn't get a lot of carbs, is the fact that we kind of have a carb overload enzyme called glucokinase. And when we take in a lot of carb, our liver kind of upregulates this enzyme and says, hey, carb overload, get it into the body. Cats only have hexokinase rather than glucokinase, and so they really can't metabolize it when it's really high in the diet. So if we were feeding 60, 70, 80%, they would metabolize it. It would just take a lot longer with this enzyme versus you and I, we would take it in, we'd turn it into fat really quickly. Then lastly, we have this enzyme in our mouth called amylase that actually starts to break down the starches, and cats don't release amylase in their saliva. Again, saying that they don't typically have high starch diets. And then lastly is they don't have sweet receptors on their tongues. So if you don't have a sweet receptor, good chance you're not going to want to eat a donut, right? However, there are plenty of cats who eat the strangest things, and I'm sure we'll get a call in about why does my cat eat cantaloupe or something like that, which is true. Cats love cantaloupe. So, so let's talk a little about obesity and what's causing obesity and my viewpoints on obesity. This was Gus, and we did a earlier in my Cornell career, I liked to study obesity. And I realized that I was fighting a bit of a losing battle, so I just stopped studying it. But I wanted to understand it a little bit better. And this was Gus McNamara, and I think that Mrs. McNamara, if she's out there, I'm going to say that she knew that there is that mass in the universe is a constant. And if Gus lost mass, somebody had to gain mass. So she would bring us these plates of brownies every time she came in for a visit. And we got him down from that body condition of about 9 down to a nice 5, and 5 is considered like ideal. And I think myself and my technician, we both gained like 5 pounds. So we gained Gus's weight to keep mass in the universe the same. But this is actually a nice little diatribe by Speakman, who's kind of one of these kings of obesity and energetics in humans. And he's done a little bit of work looking at dogs, too, with some of the publications that have been out. But this is actually the complexity. We're dealing not only with genetics, we're dealing with the environment. And this is where the environment comes in, and we say, well, you know, we have control over what we feed our dogs and cats. But let's face it, if you ever went to a cocktail party and they didn't have some chips out, you'd be like, I ain't coming back, right? Because we're always eating. And we've taken that general mantra over into our dogs and cats. Oh, we just got back from the groomer. Here's your biscuit. I got back from, you know, and we get my cat. Oh, I've missed you all day, and he's sitting there rubbing against you. Here's two more pounce treats. Like, yeah, here's your begging strip. And I think we equate food with love, and we are no better than our hosts at these parties who want to supply us with potato chips and Doritos rather than a vegetable plate, okay? Because we do that. We don't feed them the healthiest things. They look cool, and they have a little shape of a fish, so we think it's going to be great, and my cat's going to love it. We should be trying to feed them the cantaloupe, if they like cantaloupe, rather than some of these other things we're feeding, probably, just from an energy standpoint. And we have all these things in here. We have a resting metabolic rate, and you'll see me use the term resting energy requirement. Active metabolic rate, my time spent being active. There's a thermic effect of food, so protein actually creates a little bit more of a temperature rise in your body, which you have to thermoregulate. So that's where protein becomes an interesting thing in cats. And then we kind of go, when and where do you eat? Your macronutrient selection, it's energy versus intake versus expenditure. And so it's complex, but it's actually pretty simple. What you take in versus how much energy you expend. That is 90% of it. And I think we can make those choices for our dogs and cats pretty well. And what's interesting is there are all kinds of models throughout the years as to what sort of running appetite. And really, in general, I think, at least in my opinion, this lipostatic model, which is I take in energy, I actually store it as fat, but actually there's fat in my diet too. And I'll show you some interesting pathways that actually show that fat actually can satiate the appetite better than carbs can. And so there is something to fat in the diet. But in the end, when we talk about fad diets and all that fun stuff, yes, there are some subtle nuances, but still 90% of it is intake versus energy expenditure. Yeah, you can play with that 10% based on the fiber you take in, based on the kinds of fats you're taking in, the amount of fat versus protein, etc. But still, the end-all be-all is energy expenditure. So this is an interesting list of all the things that are quote-unquote orexigenic, which is makes me eat, that come from my brain or from my body, like the GI tract, which is peripheral, versus things that are anorexigenic, make me not want to eat. So you can see there's a whole bunch of things here, right? And so I think I'll use this example that our body releases things that are kind of like cannabis, right? So cannabis, which is marijuana, not that there are any users in this room, but it gives you the munchies, right? We have all kinds of interesting things that are released at the level of our central nervous system, endocannabinoids being one of them, that actually activate that same system that give you the munchies. Then we also have anorectic agents. So once again, we see extracurricular drugs make it into the list. Cocaine and amphetamine-related transcripts, right? Cocaine makes you not want to eat, makes you pretty jazzed up. Amphetamines, same thing. So we've pharmacologically known how to mess with this system. Unfortunately, it's all illegal, okay? We are now looking at ways to influence these systems in the brain as well as coming from the periphery. And so we have these two major areas within the central nervous system that are being affected by these neural peptides, and then we have things that are released from the GI tract primarily, or the pancreas, that actually also influence this system. So I'm going to mention a few hormones that are cool because they've made it into our common medicine today. The ones in red, one's called PYY, peptide YY, and one's called GLP-1. And this is our intestine here. And we have these little endocrine cells that are in our intestine system that actually release these into the bloodstream after we eat. And two of the major ones, PYY and GLP-1, actually are driving long-term satiation. So I'm satiated with my meal. What actually drives that up? Usually it's actually fat is pretty good at doing that. And so fat in the diet becomes important to the satiety effect, okay? For long-term satiety. We also have something cool called ghrelin. These two turn off your appetite. This one turns it on, okay? So ghrelin is pretty interesting because it's in your stomach. It's a small peptide that gets released when your stomach's all shrunken up and shriveled. As soon as you start to stretch it, it actually turns off the production. And so this is our normal circadian rhythm of I'm pretty darn hungry. Yeah, I can keep my brain active, but at the end of the day, if I haven't eaten lunch, my stomach's all shrunken, my ghrelin's now up, it's hitting my brain saying, it's about time to eat. And it's cool because anorexia nervosa patients tend to have an excess amount of this in their bloodstream versus people who are morbidly obese have lower amounts. So there's almost a genetic component to this too. Do I? I do have it backwards, you're right. You're right, thanks Marge. So yes, it's depressed in, because it's supposed to be stimulating the appetite. So I'm right. Okay. I'm right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm right. It's actually morbidly obese have it elevated because it's constantly hitting the brain telling them they want to eat versus anorexia nervosa where it's actually lower and so they actually don't want to eat as much because they don't have that stimulus from that hormone. So this is actually already being used, but we don't talk about it. And you guys have seen the commercials if you watch television, right? Victoza is GLP-1. It actually is an insulin sensitizing hormone. And actually, some of these things are now making it into the cat literature for diabetes to some degree too, which is kind of cool. I just saw something on a similar analog to this being used in cats that seems to be kind of cool for diabetes. Now, this actually, I didn't really pay much attention to the commercial until I actually watched my father, who used to be a four slicer, eat only two slices when he was on this for insulin sensitization. And actually, if you read the brochure, it says you may lose weight while you're on this. And the reality is this GLP-1 hits your brain and says, I'm not that hungry. So it's pretty cool. Now, what's nice is that we have companies that are now making these kinds of things for dogs and cats. We haven't got to a good appetite suppressor recently, but clinically, we're using this now, which is called Entice, which is a ghrelin analog. It actually can be given, and it actually tells the brain, I want to eat for all those dogs and cats that are in our hospital. It's only approved for dogs at this point. All the dogs and cats that aren't eating well, we can actually boost their appetite. So these are the kind of things that are going to make it in medically to most of the hospitals and things that we can use as clients to either promote or diminish appetite. Now that's kind of pie in the sky stuff. We'll get there one day. What's the best way to lose weight? Stop feeding your animal. Just stop doing it. Now this is my favorite paper written by Tony Buffington and his tech Cheryl Holloway and one of their students. And this actually followed dogs over a weight loss protocol and they actually had one group of dogs that they actually started on a weight loss protocol. And they had another group where the owners came in for client education every single month during the 6-month weight reduction trial. And when you read this, you're sitting back going, well, good, it's all about education. But you know what, want to know what happened? Those dogs lost no more weight than the other dogs that came in for their monthly assessment. So educating people did nothing to improve weight loss. But they were really successful. And the reason they were successful was because those dogs came in every single month. And if you're accountable as an owner, you're going to do it. And that's why we have to have our staff involved. We have to get our clients involved. We can't just sell a bag of pet food and say, see you next year. The reality is the more involved and the more calls you get from that annoying veterinary technician from that hospital, the more likely it is that you're going to comply. And the sad part is when we look at the therapeutic pet foods that we sell for weight loss, the actual refill rate long-term is less than, it's around 5%. So 5% compliance for weight loss. Why? Well, you go to the store and you're like, I just bought that bag of whatever it is, metabolic pills. Yeah, he seems to be doing okay on it. And I don't want to go back to the vet. I'm in Agway. Ooh, healthy weight management. Ain't no different. pick it up, you buy it, you start feeding it. Oh, this isn't working. So you quit, right? And the reality is reason that these companies are successful is they create accountability. You've got cards, you can only use so many cards per day, you have to come back and do a weigh-in, you have another session, and the last thing you're going to do the night before you go back for a weigh-in is eat a piece of chocolate cake. And it's the same thing, I think, with owners. Last thing you're going to do is feed that extra piece of chicken off your plate when you know that next week the vet tech just scheduled that appointment. You're actually going to cut that extra cup out because you hadn't been complying anyway. So really, it's about accountability. So from my perspective, the ones I can have success with are the good ones, where I know that the owner has been overfeeding. So it's a, you know, typical. It's a golden retriever who's inactive. Four cups at 350 kcals in a cup. He's eating 1,400 calories. Dog should be around 70-some. I know that if I cut the calories back, whether I use an over-the-counter or a therapeutic approach from my clinic, I'm probably going to have some pretty good success. It's this one that I'm going to have a hard time with, right? This is the Rottie who's already eating less than he really should be, because a Rottweiler who even weighs, let's say, 90 pounds should be eating more than 1,100 calories. So I know I've either got a really inactive dog, and a lot of them just aren't eating, or I've got a really non-compliant owner who's doing all kinds of things that they're not telling me. And that's the ugly part of this. And the ugly part is that people lie. This is like a bad episode of House, okay? You're not going to watch this one every week because it's the same story. People are feeding all kinds of cool things. Well, yeah, I only feed two cups a day. Really? Well, you know, he does get a rawhide. Well, he gets a pizzle stick every other day. And then, well, yeah, my husband loves to feed those big milk bones, the 125 calories of milk bone. So there's the extra 600 calories in that diet. And then, oh, yeah, he goes out and it's hunting season and he eats deer carcass all the time. You know, that's, you know, sadly, that's actually my dad's dog. He goes out and eats what's left in the backwoods. So there's all kinds of problems here in trying to get a good diet history. And if you have the time, which you do, because this is a great story, somebody came all the way from Toronto and they brought in a couple of dogs and they're like, you know, we want to try that. There was a new weight loss drug on the market and they couldn't get it in Canada, so they came all the way to Cornell. And they were about to dispense this stuff, and I just kept looking at her going, I just can't believe those dogs are only eating like a cup of that light dog. It just doesn't make sense. And the husband's sitting there reading a book in the corner. And it was almost like he wasn't in the room. And she just kept going on about the dogs and their health issues and this and that, and they're too obese, and I tried. And then I said, I don't know who's feeding these dogs, but somebody's feeding those dogs. And then she just looks at her husband and goes, honey, you haven't been feeding him. And he goes, well, I watch David Letterman at night, and I do give them each a scoop of ice cream. And then we just sat back. I said, I think I'm going to leave the room. I can only imagine what that car ride home was like, but it was pretty cool. So anyway, that's my favorite obesity story from the clinic. So when we do put them on weight loss diets, most vets are expecting 1-2% weight loss per week, so you guys can track that typically. And then, of course, there's all kinds of pitfalls, owner compliance, accountability, food equals love. This is a dog that came in, and they came in for surgery to remove this lipoma. They didn't even think their dog was fat when we asked them. So we said, can we put them on a weight loss? They didn't even want to put them on a weight loss diet. They just wanted to get that lump taken off, which is a lipoma, which actually, if you lose weight, it'll get somewhat smaller, but it's not gonna get that much smaller. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. We've seen dogs with of course, begging behaviors, breaking into the cat food, eating loaves of bread out of the pantry, trying to kill the other dog during food feeding time, things like that. So weight loss is not easy. That's why we all don't do it. For the sake of time, because it's getting late, I'll kind of go past this. But what I want to say is that over-the-counter foods that you're picking up may not even comply with what's considered to be AFCO's terms of what's a light dog food. So you really have to look at those foods. Some of the weight maintenance foods may be 450 calories a cup, which is actually a lot. That's the same as a maintenance diet. That's actually as high as a performance diet. There's no regulation unless it says light, lean, reduced fat. Those ones are the ones you're looking for because they're going to be usually less than 300 calories in a cup. Here are some of the things that make it into our diets, and some of them make it at what we'll call therapeutic levels in the therapeutic diets. Protein concentration is important for maintaining lean mass. So during weight loss, your lean mass is primarily what's burning energy. And so if you can maintain that during weight loss, you're a little bit more successful. Carnitine is actually an interesting amino acid derivative that if you actually supplement it in the diet of cats, they maintain their lean mass better during weight loss as well. So we put that into some of our therapeutic diets. And then lastly, fiber has been shown to increase satiety. Now, does it increase long-term satiety? That's kind of debatable. And if we're feeding twice a day, I'm pretty sure my lab's just as hungry at night as he was in the morning when I fed him, regardless of the fiber, and we're reducing the overall amount we're feeding. So that fiber fill effect isn't quite as good as we would probably want it to be. So how useful is it? It's probably a short-term satiety thing. And then lastly, the over-the-counter weight loss diets and senior diets all tend to be lower in protein. So if you're going out there looking for a diet that's over-the-counter to try to help with weight loss, find one that's higher than 20%. You should be closer to 30% because you're going to be feeding at a reduced level, and then you're going to want to maintain the lean mass. And when you feed a 30% diet at only 60% of the energy requirements, it's kind of like feeding a 20% diet. So you got to be aware of that. So I think that's where some of the pitfalls are of people. So my dogs have always been really lean, in really good shape, but unfortunately I also have cats. And that's not my cat, but my cat is not far off, okay? And here are all the problems with cats. It's the hardest weight loss program to really get on board with because it's been found that cats actually don't have an active requirement for metabolism. And it's like, basically I'm telling you that putting a cat in a cage and watching it breathe is about the energy expenditure of your cat at home. They have what's called a resting energy requirement. They don't even have an active energy, because what do? You go to the bowl 3 times in the morning, you go pee once, you go lay on the couch for another 8 hours. You know, you just don't have a whole lot of activity. And there are a lot of people talk about how to get cats more active, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Cats also, when you actually start to take calories away, they're metabolically different. They don't tolerate starvation very well. Okay? Yeah, fatty liver disease, right? And so dogs, it's actually been shown you can starve. There are actually studies showing you can starve a dog for like 6 weeks and they lose weight precipitously, wonderfully, and their serum chemistries look beautiful and they're happy. You can't do that to a cat. Okay? So you have to be a little bit more careful when you're doing that weight reduction. And now most of these cats are barely at resting energy requirements, which is typical fat cat needs like 160 calories a day to survive, right, to 200. Not a lot of calories. And they're nocturnal, so they will get up to eat, and they will also get up to bother you about eating at 2, 4, 6, 8, anytime you're sleeping. And cats do have what we call the dew flap. They call it the apron. So they carry their fat differently, just like, you know, people. You know, there's pear shapes, there's all kinds of shapes. Cats have a dew flap. I mean, when they carry fat, they carry it in, they call it the apron, but that thing, you know, shakes it on the ground. And anyway, they just definitely have, you know, you can feel your cat on the back and you're like, ooh, he's all muscly. And then you like turn him over and you're like, oh my God, it's Buddha, right? So they just carry it differently. That's my cat. Just shows you everybody can take a pretty good picture, but when he's laying down, there's the Buddha. Right? So I actually tried to get him to lose some weight. And I had 2 cats, and Emmy was my little tabby, and she was on a different food, and I was trying to restrict him, and he would always beat her up and try and take her food. So it was not a great situation. So I built the Fat No More box, which is right here, which she can get into to get her food anytime. But he sits outside just waiting for anything that's dropped. And so it took me about, I'm actually not a carpenter, it took me the better part of, I'd say an afternoon, a solid afternoon to build this thing and get it wedged in perfectly inside my laundry area there. And within about 2 weeks, I woke up one night hearing, hah, hah, hah. He actually had learned how to put his feet up against it and move it far enough to actually get to her food, yeah. So that wasn't working for me. But now we have cool things like this automated feeder. You wear the collar, only opens a couple times a day. You put the portion in that you need, and that's it. Cool balls, we have cool mazes. There's actually a cool box that you can actually go into that's a maze that the fat cat can't get around to get to the food. So there's all kinds of cool things out there to help you out if you're having this problem. So we were feeding Kermit twice a day. And Alex German wrote a really good paper saying cups suck. And I actually tried it out on my kids. And I actually had them each scoop out a little bit of food. And you can see the differences between my three kids, 23 all the way up to 29 grams. That is a 20 calorie difference depending on what you consider a quarter cup twice a day. So that's actually 20% of his calories. So the best solution is to get a gram scale. The people who are most successful feed certain number of grams per day. They will feed 28 grams in the morning and 32 at night or whatever, and they're far more successful. Biggest problem for me was I was tripping over my cat. My cat was butting his head against our bedroom door, and eventually my wife was gonna make me sleep with the cat because it was getting out of control. And he started fighting with the other cat, and it wasn't a great situation. But we did what we could, and the biggest trick I had was, I was at a conference, and I was telling this story to a French nutritionist, and said, yeah, my cat, you know, he just wants more and more. And she goes, why aren't you using the zucchini? And I said, zucchini? And she said, yes, cats love zucchini. It's almost like the cantaloupe thing, but less calories. And she says, about half the cats that she does weight reduction, she'll chop up zucchini, put it in with the cat food, and it takes on the flavor of what's in there because the palatants rub off. She says, mix it well, and the cat will eat it. And so at nighttime, I would feed my cat zucchini to get a little bit of weight off of him. So I did that for a few weeks. He actually would eat the zucchini, and I wouldn't get bothered till about 2:30 instead of at 11, 12, 1, and 2. Luckily, my cat's an indoor-outdoor guy. Can't stop him. He loves it. So I would just put him out at 2:30. And so we had a better lifestyle. There are ways to do it. So there's an idea that canned actually may be a better way to actually induce weight loss. So if you have a cat who likes canned cat food, they get more stomach fill. So you kind of play with that ghrelin system a little bit. If you use cat food that's canned, only tends to last like 10 days. And then their metabolism in their brain catches up. And so it's a good way to sort of jumpstart some of that weight loss. And I'm not going to talk much about this, but the evidence is poor that dry food actually leads to obesity. Backus and Patrick Nguyen out of France, they both have done studies showing that if you give Adleb high fat, high protein versus high carb, high protein, that the high fat cats always gain more weight. And these are all neutered males where the problem's the worst. And so there's really very little evidence that carbs are the culprit. It's the overfeeding. We have calorically dense food. It's 4 to 4.5 kcals per gram. And I'm telling you, a cat needs 200 calories tops. That means your cat only needs 50 grams of dry food a day. That's a pittance compared to what's in a can, which has about 160 grams, right? So no wonder you could probably curb weight gain, and you can curb overall appetite by feeding wet because they just get to take in more food, okay? So activity, should I like stop soon?
We do have to wrap
okay.
Up. Yeah.
Last thing I'm gonna say, because I won't get into the adipokine story, which is kind of a cool story, is that activity is great. You can do things to make dogs more active. However, getting a cat more active is the hardest thing to do. Yes, I watch Jackson Galaxy all the time, and I love his show about how to make a better living environment for your cat. However, the feather chase thing, and my cats, it works for about, I don't know, started off working for about 10 or 15 minutes. Now we're down to about like 60 seconds, right? So depends on the cat, depends on your lifestyle. There aren't treadmills for cats, but there are treadmills for dogs. There are underwater treadmills or exercise programs where we're just so much better at getting our dogs active. But actually, when we did a study looking at trying to get people and their dogs active, before the study, the dogs took about 6,000 steps a day. when we gave them a protocol and the rah-rah speech, a month into that, dogs walked about 6,000 steps per day. And then at the end of the study, they still walked 6,000 to 7,000 steps per day using pedometers. It's just hard to get people to change their lifestyles. So, with that, any other thoughts, questions?
Daniel, I'll be right down with the microphone.
The food that I'm feeding the one dog who can only eat a certain kind of food, the protein is soy. Do you see any problem with soy food over a long period of time?
No, not for, you know, when we talk about some of these hydrolyzed diets and using single ingredients like soy, those are well fortified with other amino acids to make it complete and balanced. So it's probably not a problem. And then there are people who talk about the estrogenic effects of soy, but they haven't been shown to affect many of the other, we'll call, systems. It's been shown to affect thyroid, potentially in people. But the studies that have been done in dogs have shown no association with soy and thyroid problems or anything like that, as well as the estrogenic effects. We haven't seen or observed any of those things. So I think it's definitely safe because there are plenty of dogs who've been on those kinds of diets long term. And actually, it's interesting because it's a fad that's starting to come up even in shelters about sustainability. There's actually, in LA right now, there's actually a bill going in saying we should be feeding vegetarian-based diets to our shelter animals. Okay? Craziness. That would be pretty soy-based, and there are veterinarians that are behind this. So.
Yeah, for what I pay per bag for the dog.
Yes, the hydrolyzed soy.
And is there a standard you should look for pretty averagely active dogs for the protein level?
In general, I like to see all dogs taking in somewhere around 4 grams per kg body weight. And that's where the nuance comes in, because if I'm feeding something that's, you know, 28% protein, 12% fat, versus 30% protein and 22% fat, I'm going to get more protein from that 28-12 than I'm going to get from that 30-22, because the calories are just more dense here. And so, I kind of like to do the math and say I'm feeding so many grams per day of this food, and it's 30% protein. I'm feeding 200 grams. Yeah, 200, you know, that's per 100 grams, that would be 30 grams or whatever, 28 grams plus another 28. That's 54. My dog's 10 kgs. He gets 5.4 grams per kg. I'm safe. That's a good spot to be in. That's for lean body mass retention. That's for long-term, normal, healthy geriatric. There's not a lot of data. There's one paper from like 1966 where they actually looked at old and dog protein requirements. And the older dogs required about 50% more than the young dogs to maintain liver DNA protein synthesis and skeletal muscle protein synthesis. So that's sort of where I play, you know, with the numbers to get a grams per kg body weight.
Okay, thank you.
So I've lost the teeth battle with my cat who has practically no teeth. So is there a problem feeding her dry food or not?
No, because if your cat's like my cat, you swallows it whole anyway.
Okay.
So if you find, and what I tend to do in those cases is not get the sharper kibbles, get the smaller round kibbles, because those are easier for the ones that, you know, if they can't really chew, then they're going to have an easier time swallowing those foods in general. And so I just tend to think it's probably a slightly better way to go. But feeding dry is fine because most of those kibbles are so small, a lot of cats just
okay, swallow. And the zucchini you were talking about raw, I assume.
Yeah, zucchini. You can do it. Yeah. I always felt like heating it up for 20 seconds in the microwave. I don't know why, but I did. But she had said, yeah, you just have to chop up fresh zucchini. And they like the edges on it too because it's a firm vegetable. So you cut it in little cubes and they tend to eat it with their food. And it does provide a little extra gastric fill in that evening meal.
Great. I think we have time for just the one last question and then we can wrap it up. Mark is distributing some evaluation forms. If you wouldn't mind just taking a few minutes and completing them before you leave, thank you in advance.
I have a really, really, really old 6.5-pound toy poodle who's got kidney issues, seizures, nerve medicine. She's got nerve pain and stuff. Any suggestions what we can do to get her to eat more? She's starting to lose weight.
That's sort of the insidious part of kidney failure, is they tend to lose their lean mass over time, no matter what. And are you on a kidney diet right now?
Yeah, Hill Science Diet, Katie. Both canned and dry, we try to get her to eat. Okay. I've resorted to feeding her by hand now.
What I do in some of those cases is I actually will feed Hill's GD and mix in small amounts of chicken or things like couscous or things like rice that have been soaked in chicken broth. Because sometimes they'll eat some of that better than they'll even eat the KD. A lot of ways to do that. And if you want to email me, Hunter and I will work on that with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Wachschlag, and thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. We'll have another Baker Pet Talks in the spring. Thank you.